is where we will be, is where we will begin. Here we are in June. At the end of the month, and Mrs. Peterson, I guess you and I can talk about this, if you want to just do 4 weeks in July or if we want to start at the end of June. Mrs. Peterson is going to do ladies' class. Guys, we will be, I don't know if we can all get in one of the other classrooms or we will be meeting in the multipurpose building for those 4 weeks, so we'll get that figured out. Ephesians 4 is where we are this morning. Let's go ahead and pray, and we will start. Father, thank you again and as always that you are timeless and eternal and unchanging, and may we appreciate that in light of the constant change that we experience in this world. Thank you that you are our rock and our anchor, and that you hold in every storm. And so may we always be focused primarily and first of all upon you. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. In conjunction, by the way, with the ladies' class that we've been planning now for some time, I think I'm going to try and we could get into so many details at this point in time in our study of religious influences. I think I'm going to try and wind it up in the broadest of terms by the end of that time, and then we'll turn our attention elsewhere after we come back. Ephesians 4, to whatever extent you care about my planning. Verses 1 through 16 is a passage that I want to read this morning. Of course, the first three chapters of Ephesians map out for us the theology of actually what we are in Christ, which is the church collectively. And then the last three chapters of Ephesians address what that means to us with reference to our earthly conduct. Verse number 1, therefore the prisoner of the Lord beseech you that ye walk worthy of the vocation wherewith ye are called, which is all that he's dealt with in the first three chapters, with all lowliness and meekness, with longsuffering, forbearing one another in love, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. There is one body, one Spirit, even as ye are called in one hope of your calling, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God, Father of all, who is above all, and through all, and in you all. But unto every one of us is given grace, according to the measure of the gift of Christ. Wherefore he saith, when he ascended up on high, he led captivity captive, and gave gifts unto men. Now, that he ascended, what is it but that he also descended first into the lower parts of the earth? He that descended is the same also that ascended up far above all heavens, that he might fill all things. And he gave some apostles and some prophets and some evangelists and some pastors and teachers for the perfecting of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come in the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, unto a perfect man, under the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, that we henceforth be no more children, tossed to and fro, carried about with every wind of doctrine, by the sleight of men and cunning craftiness, whereby they lie in wait to deceive. But speaking the truth in love, may grow up unto him in all things, which is the head, even Christ, from whom the whole body, fitly joined together and compacted by that which every joint supplieth, according to the effectual working in the measure of every part, maketh increase of the body unto the edifying of itself in love. And so that's our portion this morning. And of course, it is just a very rich passage. All that Christ has done for us on the salvation side, chapters 1 through 3, correlate to the earthly side with his direct involvement. I think that's part of the argument that Paul is making there, right? That Christ didn't just die to constitute a church and die to save men from their sins and then put us down here and go have at it, but that he himself is very active and that he gave gifts, and there is a diversity There is a unity. There's a oneness to the people of God. There's a diversity of his gifts. And there are difficulties, if I could put the passage that way, right? We on the one hand, acknowledge the unity, and on the other hand, we are prone to all kinds of perverted, distorted doctrines. And so God is working actively to bring us all to a position of perfect unity, and that's what he will do at the kingdom. And I just thought about this passage as I kind of thought about where we are with reference to our brief study of religious influences in America. Last week, we turned our attention specifically to the world of fundamentalism, and I made reference to an article written by a professor by the name of John Fay, who divides fundamentalism into four distinct periods of time: the peaceful fundamentalism, 1893 to 1919, militant fundamentalism, 1919 to 1940. And this morning, I'm just going to kind of talk briefly about the period of time between 1941 and 1960. Fay calls this divisive fundamentalism. So again, you could probably get the article, or I would be happy to give you a copy of the article if you want to read it. And as we have been doing, my focus is going to be primarily upon institutions, right? The history. The history of God's people, just about as far back as we can go in anything recorded, is that similar-minded people of God have banded together and they have formed associations, they have formed fellowships, they have formed conventions, they have formed denominations, they have started schools, they have started publication houses, they have started media ministry, ministries, they have, so that they share a common view of certain things, and then they come up with a way to promote and spread that view. And I don't mean anything critical about that. I'm just saying that's right, that's the nature of what we have done and the nature of what human beings have done. And for that reason, right, our focus tends to be more on that, on the institutional side, the associations, the denominations, the schools, and the conventions. So, and then, of course, the people who are prominent in them. So, right, so there's pretty much, and again, this is just very simplistic, right? But there are people who believe the Bible and people who don't believe the Bible. And then we have the introduction of modernism, in which people are arguing that they believe the Bible, but the Bible doesn't mean what we thought it had meant. And yet they were still using our language and still using our terminology and making different claims, and that created a whole new host of issues. So in 1907, was that 125 years ago? 1907, the Northern Baptist Convention was formed. The Northern Baptist Convention was formed. The Southern Baptist Convention, if you recall, was, I'm sure you're familiar with it, was formed in 1845. And the Southern Baptist Convention was formed specifically over the issue of slavery. One of the things, and this is still primarily true of the Southern Baptist folks, right? If we were a Southern Baptist church, like tonight, right? Tonight we're going to vote on supporting two new missionaries to us. We're going to do that as church. They travel around. They support. I am not familiar enough with the Southern Baptists to know exactly how it works, but in general, it doesn't really work that way in the Southern Baptist Convention. You support the mission. We would just send our missionary money to the Southern Baptist Convention, and it would support the missionaries that it chooses through its cooperative program. This is one of the big things that these organizations do is, right, they work together to support and promote missionary activity. So in the mid-1840s, as slavery is increasingly a heated issue, right, the question becomes, and within a Baptist association, can we support missionaries if the missionary owns slaves? Some said no, some said yes. Those in favor withdrew and started the Southern Baptist Convention. And so it was today the largest of the Baptist denominations, but it was begun so that men who believed in slave owner slavery could practice the ownership of slaves and still be ordained ministers and missionaries. That was the issue. That was where they came for. That's its own history. Okay, so those who renounced slavery, those Baptists who renounced slavery, now it's 1845, they have no single voice. They have no single organization. They sometimes work together, but they have no central organization or meeting place until the Northern Baptist Convention is formed in 1907. So is that 57 years later? After the 1845. And just like the Southern Baptist Convention, its primary aim and intention is to facilitate cooperation for missionaries. We want to organize to support missionaries to go around the world. Modernism as an issue broke out in the Northern Baptist Convention right after World War I. So World War I ended 1918, and by 1919, the Northern Baptist Convention is having its fight over modernism. I want to come back, and I want to address this because it will raise its head again. Right? Fundamentalists are known as fighters, and there's both a good side and a bad side to that. But I would point this out, folks, that the modernists did not do what I would argue was the ethical thing, which was to depart and start their own organizations. They tried to take over virtually every existing conservative institution and organization that there was. They just tried to take them over. They just tried to impose their way of thinking, and it became at virtually every level a very controversial, heated fight. And you know, so the fundamentalists were kind of put on the ropes because almost invariably the fundamentalists lost. And so he was the guy who was compelled to defend, to make an issue out of things, to stand up in opposition, and then he got slandered for so doing. In 1922, the Northern Baptist Convention held its annual convention in Indianapolis, Indiana, and the fundamentalists within the Northern Baptist Convention, and I'm going to give you some of the names you may be familiar with: Kersley Laws, J.C. Massey, John Roach Stratton, William Bell Riley. This was what they wanted to do, right? So just imagine that we're having our annual meeting. We're the Northern Baptist Convention. We're having our big annual meeting. And William Bell Riley proposed that the Northern Baptist Convention adopt the 1883 version of the New Hampshire Confession of Faith, which is pretty much a standard boilerplate Baptist Confession of Faith. Right? So, I married into a Lutheran family, so the Lutherans are very familiar with the Augsburg Confession, which is kind of their confession of faith. And if you have Presbyterian heritage, you are very familiar with the Westminster Confession of Faith, right? Just kind of a categorization of the things that we believe. We believe about God, we believe about the Bible, we believe about salvation, those kinds of things. So the proposal was, on the part of William Bell Riley, that everybody who belonged to the Northern Baptist Convention, all the leading pastors, all the pastors, would adopt the New Hampshire Confession of Faith as representing the belief system of the Northern Baptist Convention. And it, of course, folks, is going to be conservative in Bible-believing. It's going to argue for miracles and the substitutionary death of Christ and the virgin birth and the physical resurrection and the inerrancy of Scripture. And one of the leading modernists, a man by the name of Cornelius Wolfkin, simply stood up and replied that the New Testament, right, here's this quote: "The New Testament is the all-sufficient ground of faith and practice, and we need no other." And in doing that, right, he kind of put the fundamentalists back on their heels, because of course the fundamentalists would agree with that as well. that it is the rule of faith and practice. And of course, the problem is that the modernists interpreted the New Testament or the Bible completely differently than a fundamentalist did. And so it was meaningless to say. But this 1922 meeting and William Bell Riley's proposal proved a turning point. And when Riley's proposal that the New Hampshire Confession be embraced, and that was rejected, the modernists went on to control the convention. And if you're a fundamentalist, then your options are twofold. You can stay in the convention and associate with the modernists and hope, as William Bell Riley did, because he stayed in the Northern Baptist Convention almost until the day he died, and hope that you could regain the convention, or you could leave. So, again, Riley did remain. He died in 1947. In 1947, he resigned from the Northern Baptist Convention, and the entire Minnesota State Convention of Baptists left the Northern Baptist Convention, and they formed the Conservative Baptist Association of America. I think it was Dr. Richard Clearwaters who said that it was when the Minnesota Convention left en masse in its entirety, that it was one of the few times that the fundamentalists not only retained the faith, but they retained the furniture. that they got something with them when they go. Today, by the way, the Conservative Baptist Association. Do any of you have Conservative Baptist roots? Okay, we have some folks. Today it is known as the Venture Church Network. And so it has moved a little bit in, it has moved in its position, and we'll talk about that kind of movement next week. The Northern Baptist Convention was renamed the American Baptist Convention in 1950. And in 1972, it became known as the American Baptist Churches in the USA, or the ABC USA. And just, right, and I mean, we would not support them, but just for your information, right, Benson Baptist is an ABC USA church. First Baptist Church Omaha is an ABC USA church. Judson Baptist is an ABC USA church. Miracle Hills Community Baptist is an ABC USA church. There are very liberal Baptist churches right here in our beloved city. So out of this 1922 meeting, right, the Northern Baptist Convention is 15 years old, and the modernists want to make it modernist, and the fundamentalists, who are clearly the minority, want to make it a fundamentalist organization, and the fight is on, and the fundamentalists lose, and now what? And it is that 1922 convention that began the moment when fundamentalists began to realize that they had really one of three options from this point forward, apart from staying in and remaining in the fight. So fundamentalists from that point forward, from 1922 forward, have developed basically one of three theories about how to deal with modernism. One is to separate from modernism and organize in the fight against it. Right, so we're not going to be modernist, we're not going to support modernists, we're not going to join modernist associations, and we're going to unite with organizations or institutions that are distinctly fighting against modernism. In 1923, William Bell Riley, who retained his membership in the Northern Baptist Convention, J. Frank Norris, who is a man worthy of a study all unto himself, and a man by the name of William Pettengill founded the Baptist Bible Union. So we have a new organization, a new separatist, fundamentalist organization. It adopted the New Hampshire Confession of Faith. So in order to join, right, in order to join, you had to sign that you accepted and believed the New Hampshire Confession of Faith. It actually operated a college in Des Moines, Iowa. the Baptist Bible Union did. And the man who was then the president of the college, who was actually a Canadian by birth, T.T. Shields, went on then to try and force the faculty, right? If you're going to teach at this college that is associated with this new Baptist Bible Union, if you're going to teach there, you're going to sign the New Hampshire Confession of Faith. And many of them refused to sign the Confession of Faith, and so T.T. Shields fired them. Right? I'm the president of the college. One of the requirements for joining, for working at the college is to sign the New Hampshire Confession of Faith. I'm not going to sign the New Hampshire Confession of Faith. Then you no longer have a job here. And the students rioted. 1923. And so the Baptist Bible Union, on the heels of that, right? I mean, you can imagine, folks, this gets unwanted attention. It's difficult conflict. And so the Baptist Union kind of goes away. The college is disbanded. And we go off to lick our wounds. In 1932... what had been the Baptist Bible Union became the General Association of Regular Baptists. And this is an organization that a number of you have previous history with. The General Association of Regular Baptists did two things with reference to the New Hampshire Confession of Faith, which it embraced almost in its entirety. The General Association of Regular Baptists believed that the New Hampshire Confession of Faith was wrong in its position on election or Calvinism. And let me just read to you the position that the New Hampshire Confession of Faith takes. Excuse me. Article 9 of God's Purpose of Grace. We believe that election is the eternal purpose of God, according to which he graciously regenerates, sanctifies, and saves sinners, that being perfectly consistent with the free agency of man, it comprehends all the means in connection with the end, that it is a most glorious display of God's sovereign goodness, being infinitely free, wise, holy, and unchangeable, that it utterly excludes boasting, promotes humility, love, prayer, praise, trust in God, and active imitation of his free mercy, that it encourages the use of means in the highest degree, that it may be ascertained by its effects in all who truly believe the gospel, that it is the foundation of Christian assurance, and that to ascertain it with regard to ourselves demands and deserves the utmost diligence. So that they rejected. And then they added a reference to being a premillennial, to a premillennial return of Christ. So that was the 1932 beginnings. And of course, again, if you have history there, and we'll, I think at a future time I'll talk a little bit about him, but Dr. Robert Ketchum went on to become tremendously influential, just a really good, godly man in promoting and perpetuating the Regular Baptist Association. And today, right, although we are not a Regular Baptist church, all of our Sunday school curriculum for our elementary students we buy from Regular Baptist Press. Right, because, again, one of the things that these organizations did, and right, they're not demonic just in their organizational sense, but they promoted publication, media, music, and so they took their positions and prepared materials that reflected their views, and Baptist Press, Regular Baptist Press is pretty good material. So that's... that's one of the directions that was taken. Another one following the same line was the American Council of Christian Churches, or what is known as the ACCC. It was formed in 1941. It is formed as an alternative to the Federal Council of Churches, today the World Council of Churches. And as opposed to like the Baptist Bible Union and the General Association of Regular Baptists, the ACCC wanted to be separated from modernism, but open to other denominations. And so it promoted itself not as being interdenominational, but intradenominational. It would welcome it would welcome other denominations who were fundamental in their beliefs. I think I made mention of this last week. The current president actually pastors Tipton Bible Church in Tipton, Iowa. The vice president of the ACCC today is Presbyterian in Greenville, South Carolina. And if you have associations with Greenville, South Carolina, Bob Jones University, you know that there are a couple, at least, I know of one, I think more than one, maybe two, maybe three, Presbyterian churches that are on its accepted church list where you could go and you could be a Presbyterian, attend Bob Jones University. The secretary is an Evangelical Methodist, and the treasurer is a Baptist. So, one of its founders was a man by the name of Carl McIntyre. Carl McIntyre was a tremendous force for conservatism and fundamentalism. He was, by denomination, a Presbyterian, and he was later removed from the ACCC by what he called the Baptist plot. So I don't really know all the details. So again, one option, right, in light of the fact that conservatives are losing their institutions. And again, folks, if we got into more detail, these kind of fights were fought at just a variety of levels, at the denominational level, at the college level, at the printing press level. Would the modernists control it? Would the fundamentalists control it? And almost invariably, the fundamentalists were voted down. And so the modernists took over with their liberal view of Christianity. So organizations were founded that were separate from the modernists and yet viewed themselves as very much engaged with them by going after them. Or I'm sorry, first was to just be completely separated from them. The second was to organize as a Bible-believing organization but seek to engage with and interact with the modernists in an attempt to win them back. In 1942, the National Association of Evangelicals was formed. It was founded by a Pentecostal man by the name of J. Elwin Wright and a man by the name of J. Harold Ockenjay. And he pastored a congregational church in Boston. We'll get to this next week, but it is J. Harold Ockenjay who coins the expression neo-evangelical. And unlike the ACCC and the Baptist Bible Union and the GARBC, it took a deliberately tolerant or very moderate stance towards liberal institutions like the National Council of Churches. So in other words, if you wanted to join, right, if a church wanted to join the General Association of Regular Baptists, it could not be also a member of the Northern Baptist Convention. You can't do that. But if you wanted to join the National Association of Evangelicals and stay in and then join the Northern Baptist Convention, you could do that. They were not going to exclude you on the basis of that. Carl McIntyre thought this was sinful. He thought it was a sinful position to take to allow people to unite with a modernist institution and a fundamentalist institution. And the National Association of Evangelicals, which today, and we'll talk more about this next week, which today is massive in its broadness, in its association. But when it was started, its goal was to bring a conservative influence into the world of modernism. So they got very heavily involved in broadcasting because they didn't want the modernists to control all the airwaves and to control all the media and to write all the books. And so they became very heavily involved in media and publication. It was the National Association of Evangelicals that sponsored the translation of the New International Version. Now, again, in a church like ours, right, many people with fundamentalist background have a hard time saying the words NIV without spitting. But the NIV was actually translated to be a conservative alternative to what was then considered the Bible of the liberals, the RSV. The liberals were using the Revised Standard Version. They had gone that direction. And the NAE said, we need an alternative. We need something that is viewed by all conservatives as a conservative alternative to the RSV. And so they translated the NIV. And if you ask what's wrong with the KJV, I don't know. I didn't get all that far into the history of the NIV. That's not the point of this Sunday school lesson. But it was willing to engage and talk to and, in very limited loose form, associate with those on the modernist side of the camp. So there is your second alternative, right? Modernism takes over Westwood Heights Baptist Church. And you're not a modernist. So you can band together with others like-minded and form your own separatist institutions. Or you can do as the National Association of Evangelicals did. You can separate from the modernists, but still engage with them civilly. Civilly, right? Sincerely, not just to lob shells at them, but to engage with them civilly. That's what the NAE attempted to do. Or you can just withdraw and not have anything to do with anybody. You can just separate and be completely isolated. Let me give you two names that you're probably somewhat familiar with. Both of these men were early 20th century evangelists. They didn't really pastor churches for very long. John Rice pastored briefly. But they were primarily men who were evangelists. And that matters for the kind of work that they did. Being an evangelist, and we will get into this a little bit more when we talk about Billy Graham. Being an evangelist, this is true of D.L. Moody, right, who is arguably the greatest evangelist that America has ever fielded, and Billy Graham. Being an evangelist, folks, is really kind of a horse of a different color. So Bob Jones and John Rice were both evangelists. And they both, in the early days, 1940s, joined the National Association of Evangelicals. And they both joined the National Association of Evangelicals because they believed that the ACCC was too strict and too rigid in its principles of separation. So they just felt, and they just felt like the ACCC as an organization would impede their efforts as an evangelist. Again, folks, when I say an evangelist is a horse of a different color, right? I'm not talking about a guy, I want to, give me a second to kind of think through what I'm going to say here, because I'm not trying to shoot myself in the foot. For many of us, when we think of an evangelist, we think of a guy who travels from church to church and preaches. And that's what he does. He goes around and he travels from church to church and he preaches, and maybe he holds revival meetings. And I don't really want to get into all of that apart from saying this. He's not an evangelist. He's a guy who travels from church to church and holds meetings. Right? Evangelist, on the basis of the very limited biblical information that we have, do not do their work in churches. Evangelists do their work really where there are no churches. In British and American history, evangelists like that have relied upon church support, but they do not. Billy Graham didn't preach in churches. He preached in civic centers with the support of a lot of churches. D.L. Moody didn't really preach in churches. He preached in open air or big amphitheaters or meeting places where many people could come. And he relied upon the support of churches. But these men have historically relied upon the support of lots of kinds of churches, not just Baptist churches. And so Bob Jones and John Rice felt that the ACC's position on separation was going to impede their work and be a hindrance to their work. So they did not join it. They joined the National Associations. Now, National Association of Evangelicals. The National Association of Evangelicals ultimately did not support their work, right? Because it wasn't the kind of work that they wanted to do. They were not interested in citywide campaigns and citywide crusades. They were interested in publication and media, use of, in those days, the radio. And that was where their interests lie. And so eventually Bob Jones and John Rice left. And that brings me to my third alternative, right? When an institution goes liberal, what are your options? You can unite with an organization that is conservative and has nothing to do with modernism. You can unite with an associate with an organization that is conservative but has some engagement with modernism. Or you can just withdraw from everybody and kind of go it alone and not really be a part or organize anything. And that was where they did. And of course, Bob Jones University is today a part of or instrumental in the Fundamental Baptist Fellowship. But it didn't really start that way. So those would be your options. Okay? Those would be your options. And just if you haven't thought this far, haven't figured this out or thought through this, right? My personal history and the history of Westwood Heights Baptist Church has been alternative number three. Right? We really are, folks, completely and totally unaffiliated at an institution organization level. I personally am not a part of anything. I belong to no association, no organization, no denomination. I'm the pastor of a local church, and that is that, right? There are colleges that I would support. There are men that I would support, but we're not a part of that, and that's just really not a part of our church life. And I got saved into that, and before I ever knew any of these things, I was already well on my way in that. So just for that. Okay, I'm a little early today. Questions, comments, critiques, challenges? Everybody's happy. Everybody wants a donut and another cup of coffee. How do people like Lester Roloff fit into this?